This is, of course, the January 30th, 2019 statutory interpretation class. And I wanted to, as always, begin with a couple of announcements. Today, actually, not a whole lot. I wanted to just gently remind all of you that I do have office hours. And I have not seen a few folks. That's typical this part of the semester, but I am there. I just want to assure you, Tuesday in the afternoons, the entire afternoon, I know you guys aren't free until after 3, but I'll certainly stay after 3. Here's the key thing. If you want to meet me beyond that window, let me know. I am glad to schedule any get-together at any location, at any opportunity that you want to talk. So don't overlook it. Don't wait till the end of the semester. It starts looking like O'Hare and rush hour. You don't want to do that. And frankly, it's not a bad thing just to get to know your professors, not even just me, but all of your professors. We are people who can actually help you down the road even when you get done with our classes. So with that, I also had one other just quick question. How many of you are planning to watch the Super Bowl this weekend? No, you're supposed to be studying. All right. I heard a boo there, by the way. Is that a Texans fan?
No, it was a Saints fan.
A what?
A Saints fan.
Oh, man. I don't know. I think you may need to talk with your crim law professor about theft statutes. Okay, so with that, let's dive right in. We've got a lot of ground to cover, and I'm going to begin just by giving you guys a clear signal. We're probably not going to get through all the reading material because you had a big assignment for today. We're probably not going to get very much into the executive participation in lawmaking until our next class. Then we'll combine those. Those of you who like to get a head start on your weekend reading, especially with the Super Bowl, hold off. Give me a little bit of time. I realized after looking at the reading today and their next reading coming up, it's a lot of pages, so I'm going to trim the next reading. I know that disappoints some of you. But you guys are supposed to love reading this stuff. Okay. So with that, let me begin by asking you, usually I do a look back, but our look back, of course, is Jason Smith. So I wanted to get honest feedback from you guys. And I am glad to delete this part of the recording. But this is the first time I've asked Jason to speak to the classes. Usually we have either a state legislator come in, or I've asked the person in charge of lobbying for Harris County or corporations to come in. He's the first person who's actually inside the family to come in and talk about what U of H's concerns were and how we do the legislative process. So I'll just start by throwing out a real softball. Was that useful information for you? And feel free to say thumbs up, thumbs down. Okay? All right. Anything that you would suggest to make it better the next time?
So I was kind of hoping to get like a step-by-step, like this is what I would go through on like a daily basis of trying to get it done instead of I did X and I did Y type of thing. Like there's a lot of gray area missing from that we could have taken more out of than just like.
So if I could undiplomatize that language. Fewer war stories, more nuts and bolts. Okay, fair enough. And I do have something that might help in that regard, but I want to offer it up with a very big caveat in just a minute. Okay, and please, when you say sir, it's like a wound to the heart. Byron?
I think it might be more useful if we had something like this later on in the semester, if we have more information and that you can see kind of just like things like talking to a crowd, people
that
know what's going on.
No, a very fair call. Did anyone else feel that way? I'm sorry? Yes, sort of, kind of, not so sure. Just so you know, Byron, usually it is later. I usually save it till the very end of all the legislative process classes, but the session is underway, so this is the only possible time you could do it. The other thing is that, remember, we're just one of the three sections. I'm not sure if you guys realize this, but some of the other sections are doing it completely differently. They're not even talking about the legislative process. They've just dived right into administrative law. Other sections, I think, are doing legislative, but at a different pace. So we just kind of had to hope throw you guys in the deep end of the pool and hope your heads reemerged at some point. But it's a very good point. If I can, I will try and push it to February next time around. Yes, I'm sorry, you first. Really? Mm-hmm. Very good point. Number one, I don't think he graduated from law school. He's a poli-sci guy. But number two, if that's something you are interested in, and I offer this to anyone who's interested, but it may be a little bit first come, first serve. On the same, on Wednesdays, I actually have a class where every week I bring in a speaker who actually practices outside of campus. And one of the things we talk about is how they got into law, how they chose their career, what sorts of things they'd advise students to do to get started in their careers. Of course, being who I am, it's environmental, but there's still lessons that you could draw from that. Today we're having a partner coming in from Pillsbury to talk about it. You know, next week we're going to have the assistant district attorney coming in. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, just give me a heads up and I'll be glad to let you know with a schedule and plug you into any particular class you might want to watch. But I don't think Jason can help you very much with that. I think he's proud not to be a lawyer. Yes?
I was going to say, like, I have a similar reaction to Michael, but also, like, I feel like what he has to offer us that the textbook doesn't are those real stories that the textbook will say, and then there's trade favors, and there's law and ruling, but we don't really get any window into what that looks like.
So more nuts and bolts flavored with real war stories about how the seamy stuff goes on behind the curtain. Okay, fair enough. In fairness, I don't think he can say things like that without getting fired. But I'm glad to share with you what little I've seen, if that will help. But is this something you're thinking about doing at some point?
No.
I'm not sure how to respond to that. Fair point, very fair point. And if you'd like, I might segue to some comments I'll offer up that maybe add some of these the behind the curtain things I can add from just sort of my tangential involvement. But I will simply begin by saying, by the way, if there are any other comments, I'll make sure I don't exclude anyone. I know there's surprise, as always, it's always lots of fun. Some of you in the class actually have worked in the legislature, either as interns or in senatorial offices. So I know you have a special perspective on this. Feel free to throw in your particular your vantage point when you can. I'm sorry, were you? Oh, I thought you were outing somebody, say, call her. I'll remember that, Maurice. Okay. It's his fault. He volunteered you. So here's a few things I'll offer. Number one, what Jason said is actually not outside the cultural norm of the lobbying world. It's very different than the law world. If any of you are interested in doing lobbying work, and I'm going to offer some thoughts on that in just a second, I'll just give you a little bit of a heads up. It's very different than legal practice economically. Law practices right now, be it big firms or small, tend to be built around either billable hours, as you guys all probably already know and love. Anyone had a chance to log timesheets yet? It's a special feeling. Yeah. But yes, there's heavy sarcasm there. But lobbyists are different. A 10-minute phone call can save a client $10,000. So they tend to work very much on a flat retainer basis or a straight-up bill-by-task arrangement. Law firms, as a result, have a very hard time incorporating full-fledged lobby shops into their economic models. So what you tend to have is this very uneasy tension between lobbying groups and how they economically justify themselves in large law firms. And what you oftentimes see is exactly what Jason's talking about. You log some time, you build the network, you promote your relationships, and then you go out, and most of the powerful lobbyists tend to have small or solo operations. There are exceptions. Akin Gump, Locke Lord, Bracewell all have very strong lobbying groups, but that's because the firms basically understand that disjunction and they're willing to swallow hard and accept it. But it makes it hard for guys like you, as a result, to sort of get into the practice through the typical law firm model without actually spending time in a legislative operation. So does that sort of give a little bit of insight? So with that, let me offer a few other caveats and thoughts. And by the way, this is lore. It's not law. It's not something that's going to show up on a final exam, so I'll be brief with it as I can, but I think it might be useful. Number one, Jason was right. Law firms and lawyers can use lobbyists very effectively. That's not just to get legislation done. It turns out that most lobbyists tend to have very strong relationships with the executive branch as well. And I have worked with lobbyists who have been very effective at being able to reach people who are at the high decision-making levels of agencies outside of an adversarial context where ex parte rule communications apply. But nonetheless, injecting a perspective in a way that is almost impossible to do unless you have a long-standing pre-existing relationship. There was one case I was involved in that dealt with literally a fight that had been going on for nearly 6 years. And it basically, a lobbyist who happened to be the former chief of staff to the governor had to sit down and talk with some key decision makers in the agency that we were tangling with, and it broke the logjam. So I can tell you it could be extraordinarily effective, extraordinarily cost effective. Just have to be careful, because point number two is it's dangerous. Some lobbyists are actually legislators, sitting legislators. And as a result, they tend to be hired because of their dual role. That means that if you're not really super careful, enormously difficult ethical issues pop up when you hire a legislator to help you on a task if it can be in some way portrayed as coloring his or her official duties. A friend of mine who is very well respected nationally, he was going to be the incoming president of the American College of Environmental Lawyers, got indicted by a federal prosecutor because his law firm hired a lobbyist who was a sitting legislator who went to a community meeting and made a statement as a legislator without disclosing that he was also being paid as a lobbyist by the law firm. And that was deemed to be corrupt influence in the political process. Two of his partners indicted and convicted on felonies. He was ultimately dropped, not prosecuted. It didn't matter. His career, I think, is never going to recover. So my strong suggestion to you is use lobbyists sparingly, use them cautiously, use them with a clear eye as to where they fit, and be aware of the dangers. Does that make sense? Have I scared everyone enough for a good Wednesday morning? Third point, congratulations. Many of you may become lobbyists without knowing it. How many of you are familiar with Texas's lobbying registration requirements? Yeah, it's the requirement that's most likely to apply to you, you'll never hear about. Only takes payment to you and compensation of $500 during the course, I'm sorry, $1,000 in the course of a calendar quarter. If you're hired at your law firm to represent a client's interest directly to a legislator to get a bill passed, and your billable hour rate is, you know, let's say, I'll just make something up, $400 an hour, it includes your prep time. So as a result, you half a day, you easily trigger the requirement to register as a lobbyist in Texas. If you spend more than $500 on that lobbying issue, that also gets you over the threshold. And if you don't register and declare what you're doing, that is subjecting you to fines and, more importantly, potential disbarment. So tread cautiously. Okay, does that help? Yes. Oh, absolutely. And also, they either have it in-house, which puts Jason and others like him in a very weird position in that they can't lobby for the things that they're trying to advocate. So that's why he can't urge passage or denial of a bill. He's a state employee, and there are limits to what he can actually lobby. If you're working at a 501c3, same issues apply as well if you're working in particular nonprofits. What some universities do instead is they hire outside law firms who are able to do that. But I'd say the big ones, the Harvards, the Penn States, the USCs, they tend to have in-house lobbying operations. So if that's something you want to do, let's talk. There's some very good people in Houston who do it at a national level. Any other quick questions.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you mean in the sense of that you are lobbying on behalf of someone in Texas and the team you're going up against inside the Beltway is from the Harvard?
I'm saying nationally, like, isn't it kind of, you know, how many presidents have come from Harvard, Yale? It's like, isn't it kind of better to have to pay a firm to lobby for you when the people who are making the bills are already lobbying for you because they're
online? That plays a role, but it's not as much your educational, you know, where your mascot is. It's more a question of whether or not you've worked with them previously in a legislative capacity. That tends to be the closed circle. And, you know, and if you add in the fact that certain legislators, once they retire, still have floor access privileges in the Capitol that no one else have, that gives them an additional layer of protection around the magic circle. Does that sort of get what you're asking? Okay. All right, then the... I think that was about all I was going to talk about today, unless you guys had any other questions about lobbying, what Jason had to say.
Were you just saying that the university used to use state money to hire a lobbyist? Doesn't that kind of get around the whole can't argue for state?
They can do that. And they actually do that. The outside law firm that's the lobbyist is Locke Lord. They've been doing this for a long time. They're excellent. Nationally, it's a different law firm. Ironically, give me 10 minutes and I promise it'll pop up from my subconscious if you're interested. But we do use outside law firms, but they have to work under Jason's direction, so it's kind of an interesting dance they have to do. They're also on retainers, so you can call anytime you need to. All right, any others? Okay, then with that, take a deep breath. Remember, we always look back. Well, we're going to look back now past Jason to our last class on Wednesday. Remember, what we are focusing on now is a review of the legislative process, mostly at the federal level. And I promise you that I will be coming back to this Texas process in a minute, so you'll have some more detail. From an advocate's perspective, not only how you can try or get bills passed or kill them dead, but also having a sense of how the process works, because it will color what you're going to be doing as lawyers when you're interpreting statutes before judges, or when you're arguing before agencies what the statute should be making the agency do, whether they like it or not. So with that, we've talked about the process stem to stern, both in the House, the Senate, reconciliation, and the executive branch. With that in mind, I will give you a resource. I want to stress to you, this is a resource. It's not something you need to read, put on flashcards, or commit to memory. Hopefully it just repeats things we've already talked about, but it's a graphic that might sort of help you refer to it as we get towards the end of the semester. It's a PowerPoint that's on the website. And I'm just going to point out to you, it's for today's reading. It's just mysteriously labeled PowerPoint, but if you click it, if all works, and the software is giving me fits today, it should give you a PowerPoint deck. Aha! So no big surprises here, but just want to sort of put it up there so you know where it's at. Before we do a walkthrough, which I'll try and do super fast because we have other things to do today, I want to try and do something a little bit different. It's really boring to hear me say, and here's how a bill comes into law. What I'd like to do is to take, I assume, what's ingrained in all of your collective minds and make it functional. So I want to basically just ask a simple question. And since you've been pushed in front of the bus already, Maurice, can I ask you to help us out with this? Okay. I want you just generally, if you were trying to kill a bill dead that was being introduced into either chamber of Congress, name the three best pressure points that you would advise your client to focus on outside of a filibuster. You have 5 minutes. I'm sorry, but you have to speak up. I'm pretty sure if I can't hear you, can you guys hear? All right. That's constructive criticism.
Okay.
If I was another professor, I'd make you stand up and declaim proudly. So. Okay. So that's a bit generic. Where? Which committees? How? Who do you talk to? Okay, let's make this more clear. What's a bill you hate? Let's just make up something that would just make your skin crawl if it actually passed Congress. And you don't, I'm not asking you to, you know, make a political statement or say anything personal, but just something that you think doesn't deserve to see the light of day. Okay. All right, a nice small little thing to tickle. All right, how are you gonna kill it? You're sitting in a DC inside the Beltway conference room, there's a big whiteboard, there's a team of lobbyists looking at you saying, what do we do? You just came out of U of H, tell us what the law says where the best place to attack is. And you say, refer to the committees, and they say, which ones, who do we talk to? All right. Well, again, project. Okay. So, which one? Which committee? There are multiple. There's a rat's nest of committees. You know, most fundamental, House or Senate? Why the House? And the appropriate answer is not because that's what the civil rights did. Okay, the sands are running. The pressure's on. You can call your team to help you if you need to. You have a circle of friends who will be locking arms with you for the rest of your professional career, surrounding you in the warmth of their support. I'm sure any of them would step up and volunteer if they had something to offer. Now you're getting the professor's experience where you suddenly realize all your friends are reading very closely in their books and the screens. I'm sorry, who? I think she enjoyed that way too much. So just offhand, House or Senate, which committees are you going to go after?
I want to say House.
Why? All right. 1 second. Maurice, I do want you to realize I've tricked you. I've given you a false choice. Why choose? Why not do both? House and Senate. Okay, so if we're going to do it in the House, I'm sorry, Dad, I didn't mean to deprive you of your moment in the sun.
That's okay.
All right, so who decides where they go in the House? Okay, so do you know Nancy? Okay, but let's just assume that, she's someone that we can reproach, either ourselves or through the right other relationship. Who in the Senate? And this is one of those tricky little questions that are just fun to ask because it's a great multiple choice question. So you're going to talk with Mitch? I see you shaking your head. No, that's a very dangerous thing to do.
Isn't the parliamentarian's office?
Parliamentarian, yes. Absolutely correct. Not terribly helpful. The parliamentarian is by design expressly nonpartisan office, who's mainly viewed as a fount of expertise. But nonetheless, in theory, the parliamentarian makes the call. But you're probably right, Mitch is the one who's going to have the real say as to the place it should go. You want multiple committee referrals? I assume that you're just going to do death by 1,000 cuts?
Yeah.
What's your argument that the wall goes anywhere but immigration? That means it goes one committee, you're done. That's not what you want.
Healthcare?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sound so incredulous. I really genuinely don't see. You've got about maybe a minute. The last grains are circling around the... Let me suggest, it's going to go straight through one of the nation's premier butterfly sanctuaries, right along near near Brownsville. It's going to have dramatic effects on species migration. It's going to have tremendous impacts on economics of border businesses that can no longer cross back and forth. I know that there are ranches right now that just don't know what they're going to do because they're going to lose access to water that they need in the Rio. So with that in mind, that's one. You still have two more to go. It could go to agriculture, it could go to justice, judiciary, it could go to environment, natural resources. There's lots of places you could throw this in the briar patch. Okay, anything else? Well, I'm not talking about committees now. You still have two other arguments to raise in about 10 more seconds for your last grains right out. You want to kill it dead. And by the way, just to assume, of course, filibuster's always in the pocket there. All right, throwing it open. Anyone else?
Can you try to introduce a poison pill amendment?
What's a good poison pill here? Well, just an example. What would kill this bill dead that's going to create a wall along the southern border? Expanded asylum rights. Nothing. I deserve that. I was wondering how some members of the administration might respond if there was a provision that expanded asylum rights as part of the quid pro quo of letting a wall go up. Okay. I like it. That's very poisonous, but still sounds noble. Okay. Anything else?
Oh.
Oh. It's a little in your face, but I do like it. Okay. But that's only two. Poison pill, multiple committee referrals, anything else? I'm sorry?
If it passes both houses, you can kill it in the conference committee.
Okay, how would you kill it in the conference committee?
Just find something that both sides don't agree on and just focus on that.
Okay. So the conference committee tends to pass bills out because 90% of the work's already done. So that's kind of saving it to the end of the game and hoping your half-court shot goes in. But it might work. Or that someone actually captures a pass in the end zone. Anyway, I'm sorry, what? True. Okay. So, does this help recall to everyone not only the process, but the way you use that process? That's what I care about. I don't want to turn this into a political science class. I don't want to turn this into a commentary on the current political landscape. I want you to walk out of here with the capacity to read where a bill came from and know which parts of that process mattered, because that's the gauntlet the bill had to go through to survive. There are certain choke points, certain veto gates that we've talked about that make parts of this process more relevant when you're deciding what a statute means. There are certain parts that make it more relevant when you're telling an agency they've got to do something they don't want to do because the statute wouldn't have passed if it hadn't run through these choke points. So therefore, that part of the record matters more than something else that may have occurred earlier or something else that doesn't deal with the particular issue that's germane. Does that make sense for everybody? Okay. So Maurice, I'm not sure you made it within 5 minutes. So yeah. But you can blame Danny if you'd like. You can blame Danny if you'd like. It's, you know. Okay. Well, then, here you go. You can use this as a time any other answers today if you like. Okay, by the way, where's the opt-out sheet? Maurice, I hope you didn't opt out. If so, I really apologize. Oh my God. Okay. This may make it a more challenging class today. However, I feel comfortable that I never intended to call Barack Obama. Okay, so I made a few promises. Let me deliver them before time gets too short. Number one, I'd promised, no, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Michael?
Michael Holmes. Okay, so you realize that I'm going to forever remember your name by referring to you in my mind as Sherlock from now on.
Yes.
Okay, so Michael, you'd asked for more detail on the Texas process. I want to remind everybody that on the website for readings for last week, two things are up there. These are not materials I'm holding you responsible for, but they're there for your future use and reference. One is a simplified flow chart that just walks through how the Texas legislative process works. I would normally delight in spending enormous amounts of time walking through it, but it's not really important for us in this class at this point because in most basic respects, it really does look a lot like the federal process with some important differences. For example, the power of a pocket veto is much greater in a state. The composition politically of the chambers is different. Quorum rules are a little different, but nonetheless, you recognize the bicameral structure, the referral process, the committee reviews, the opportunities for filibuster, those echoes are there. So here it is. If you print it out, be prepared. The type is microscopic, so you might want to just use it instead as an online resource, but I wanted to let you know it was there. Second, remember I said last year we had Representative Sarah Davis, who's just won re-election, as well as House Parliamentarian, Texas House Parliamentarian Chris Griesel come in. They also brought a PowerPoint that also walked through the Texas legislative process. So I want to let you know that's available to you as well. Again, do not lose sleep this weekend. Do not miss the Super Bowl. Do not worry about reading this in the harsh hours of midnight before the final exam. This is just a book on the shelf for you if you need it. So hopefully, Michael, that's something that will help answer some of your questions. So with that in mind, the other process, other promise I made was I was going to give you a very quick graphic resource that you can use for the legislative process for our class discussions. So remember I had a PowerPoint up here a moment ago that I foolishly shut down. See if we can get back open again. All right, I don't want to, believe it or not, we're still reviewing a little bit here, but this is really important stuff, so I'm going to do this super fast, though, because I'm going to work on the assumption, based on our experience right now with Maurice, we already know most of what I'm about to show you. What I've got here, essentially, first of all, I couldn't resist. This was a formative experience for me growing up, so you know, part of the reason I'm a lawyer is thanks to Schoolhouse Rock. This is a graphic breakdown that goes to the deeper layers of how the House and Senate procedures work. So essentially, though, notice most of this is straight out of the book. Most of this is going to be very familiar to you. What I want you to see it basically is in flow chart algorithmic form. So you know exactly how you should take a look at it and think about it. So for example, the opportunity we just had here for multiple committee referrals and assignments, both committee and subcommittee, which we didn't talk about. Opportunity for intersection of post-poison pills, that's going to be probably during the debate on the floor, is the most likely, or during the markup before the subcommittee. And the conference committee, just by the way, for each step, there's a little bit of detail. Remember, only House members can introduce a bill. Remember that the speaker refers to the committee. It can be multiple or primary. But in theory, the House is not required to actually, and the committee is not required to actually consider the bill. A lot of bills die from simple parental neglect. They just never get a hearing. And there they stay, and they languish until the next session. Third, referral to the subcommittee, some of the similar rules. And then hearings. Again, hearings not required, but the key thing here is markups. That's where a lot of the legislative sausage gets made. Reported out by there, but notice this little tiny point at the bottom here. If I had a magic marker, I could mark on the screen, which would be a very bad idea. This is the committee report that comes out of the actual markup and referral process and review in the hearings. This is usually a seminal document if you're before a judge that looks to legislative history materials to interpret a statute. We'll talk about this more later in the semester, but it's essentially one of the most gold standard materials you can have. Once it gets out of committee, of course, it can be shot in the back, but usually that doesn't happen. and then it goes to the Rules Committee. Now, we had a fabulous question asked during the review session with Alex Grafton. By the way, for those of you who are interested, take advantage of Alex. She's wonderful. She has a really interesting background before coming to law school. She's going to be going clerking before the Fifth Circuit, so she's someone who can really help you with this class. But she got asked a question as to whether or not the techniques you use to get a committee to review a bill, remember the calendar Wednesday? Remember the motion that you have to have by majority of members to actually have the committee bring it up? Did those apply to the Rules Committee too, as opposed to just the Subject Matter Committee? So quick, this is why I love about this. It's a great question because it's also a review question. You all already know the answer. Can you do a discharge petition in front of the Rules Committee of the House? I heard a yes quietly.
Yes.
Is that based on your background?
Civil rights.
That's right. That's exactly what happened with, remember, the House Rules Committee with the Civil Rights Act. That discharge petition was actually considered and moved in the Rules Committee, not in the Antitrust Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. So great question, and it's one of those great ones because it's also one that's already answered for you. So any questions about that? Yes. Usually in concert with the ranking member and the chair. It can't just be the ranking member.
So they can change a key language to say, like, they can change a yes from a no?
In theory, yes. Okay. In real world, it has to be extraordinary circumstances. Okay? Anything else? All right, marching along. We're now for the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee selects the key things here, open, closed. Remember, open means fair game. Closed means that you have rules defining when you can debate, how long you debate, what kind of germane amendments can be added to the bill. So most rules are closed. Having said that, the House can suspend the rules if it chooses and debate the bill itself. But if the rule doesn't actually get out of the committee, the Rules Committee, usually the bill never gets considered. So debate, the committee of the member, the formation of the committee of the whole, streamline quorum rules. And then after the debate's concluded with floor amendments, which remember there is not a floor vote record during this discussion, it goes to reconvention of the House. And then it's passed in the full House consideration. And that's when you can force record votes. Deep breath. This is fast. Any questions? Because hopefully this is all just recollection for you. That's just step one. That's the full list right there. But we haven't even gotten to the Senate. Senate, very similar. We're not going to go through in the same degree. Key things here, referral to the committee by the parliamentarian. It can go to one committee, but multiple referrals are discouraged by the rules, but can happen. There is no germaneness rule for amendments offered to the legislation. There is no Senate Rules Committee to dictate the length, subject matter, and terms of debate. That's why the filibuster is such an important tool in terms of getting legislation passed or killed in the Senate. Same consideration in hearings and committee reports. Senate committee reports are just as valuable as House committee reports. And then post-committee revisions as well. Here's where it gets really different. Unanimous consent agreements. You typically are what are required to get your bill to the floor. That means if you have one person who wants to read a critique of Pure Reason by Kant from the podium, or Green Eggs and Ham, it doesn't matter, one senator can spike the process. Usually they don't have to, they just do what's called a hold. The book talks about that. Essentially it's a painless filibuster. You notify the majority leader that this is going to be a bill that you intend to filibuster, and that's it. That's considered to be enough to prevent a unanimous consent agreement that would allow consideration of the bill. We'll talk about this a little bit more in a few minutes, but I just want to remind everyone that the filibuster, the key things here is the 60-vote threshold, which is the current requirement now. The cloture vote also doesn't require a full 60, but only 16 votes. And then usually, once it's invoked, the key things to watch out for, the pitfalls that could cause malpractice claims, 30 hours of debate, typically. And you can offer germane amendments, but only if they're filed before the cloture motion passes. If you wait, you're screwed. Okay? So with that in mind, does that sort of help refresh your recollection of how this whole process works? This is sort of textbook you know, how it should work if you if everything goes according to your civics class. So let's start. Yes, is that your hand going up or your question? Mm-hmm. That's what Bob is just about to talk about. And we will get into this in some detail, because what I want to do now, by the way, notice what I haven't done here is talked about the post-committee consideration process. Let me do that very quickly, then I'm going to come back and answer your question. Once it is referred out and there's differences between the bills, you have the committee, conference committee review. Normally, it's the key players on both chambers brought together. Watch out, it has really weird voting rules, and that the majorities from each chamber must be able to vote in passage rather than just a simple up majority. And then they usually have a limited mandate. They can only harmonize conflicts. They can't go back and look under the hood for the rest of the bill where the House and Senate agree. Gets out, then you still have to get it passed in each chamber by majority. Once repassage takes place, the president signs it, and of course we have the whole question about veto power and presidential signing statements, which we'll talk about over the next couple of weeks. So, who recognizes this happy-looking fellow? Yes?
Chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Who is?
Chuck Grassley.
Very good. So, Chuck Grassley is relevant here because the question came up, nuclear option. That 60-vote margin required to overcome a filibuster and a cloture motion. Well, notice it doesn't apply to certain types of appointments. Who remembers, I guess as part of your first year of class, you had the unique experience of watching the judicial confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. And remember what the vote was to get him confirmed on the Supreme Court? Was it 60 plus? No, you're right. You should say it.
No.
Thank you. You guys are now recorded on video for all posterity. I look forward to your future Senate confirmation hearing. Okay. That's because of the nuclear option. The nuclear option was essentially the invocation of a particular process which says that certain types of Senate decisions are not subject to filibuster. And here, I will try and condense this a bit, and this is something I can spend some time on because it's important. The filibuster is not in the Constitution. You will look fruitlessly to find the language in there that creates it. It is the result of Senate custom and practice and rules. Now, what that means is that the Senate therefore has the capacity, if it chooses, to change the way it uses filibusters or whether to even have filibusters at all. Now, the catch has always been, of course, what happens if a senator introduces a bill or a proposal to do away with filibusters? What's the first thing someone's going to do if they like filibusters? Awesome! You guys have had your coffee this morning. Okay, so it turns out the nuclear option simply means that there is a process where the Senate can find and define what it considers to be what are called precedents. Precedents are really not subject to filibuster. They're a straight up simple majority vote. If you're going to change the rule itself, that has to go through the subject to filibuster. If you're going to get an agreement or other type of order, like a unanimous consent agreement, that also can be subject to filibuster. But precedents do not have to go through that process. So every new Senate, in theory, is not bound by the prior Senate. The first thing that Senate does is it passes its own rules, and under precedential agreements that the Senate has been bound by, that is only by simple majority vote, and that is an opportunity for the Senate to basically redefine what is subject to filibuster. The nuclear option has been invoked earlier by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to remove judicial appointments below the Supreme Court from filibuster requirements. That was viewed at the time as a very major step with a lot of dangers, because as predicted, when control of the Senate changed, the very same nuclear option was invoked to include U.S. Supreme Court justices in their confirmation hearings, and therefore they are not subject to filibuster either. Does that make sense for everybody? Yes?
I have a couple questions. So would it be unconstitutional for them to be able to
Supreme Court justice, like, I guess their appointments anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And also about the Germain thing with Senate, how they can just add amendments to bills that are unrelated. Is there a certain level of, like, discretion they have to use where it can't be completely unrelated, or do they just add, like, random amendments to stuff?
The answer to your second question first, no germane means it doesn't have to be germane. You could pass the National Appreciation of Fire Salamanders as part of the National Nursing Act. It's just, there are non-legal cultural barriers where you certainly burn political capital or invoke the wrath of your party if you do particularly stupid stuff that makes people look silly. But legally, under House Senate rules, there's no subject matter connection at all that's going to be imposed. Now, I'm sorry, and your first question, I thought I followed it and I lost the thread. No, it doesn't. It simply says the Senate has power to advise a consent of presidential appointees. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that it is subject to a filibuster or that there's a certain vote threshold that must be met. So the filibuster is an interesting creature. And there are folks who really think that it is unconstitutional. That it is a simple tool which the minority interest can override the majority interest. The Senate does it because of reasons that are rooted in history, but not necessarily in constitutional allocation of power. So I'll just simply say, given what's happened, the odds that the filibuster will return for appointees seems very low. Now, here's the key thing, and I know, oh, I'm sorry.
The House does have a role with the no taxing germane bill passing.
If the House Rules Committee passes a closed rule, the amendments usually must be germane in that circumstance. It'll define germane. You're quite correct. It has to survive the conference committee process. So, and you know, if it's a particularly stupid amendment that's not germane, the odds are pretty good the conference committee might prune it out. But nonetheless, the House doesn't have to accept a non-germane amendment in the conference committee. Yes? I'll be honest with you. That one is fuzzy to me, too. What I know for sure is that the rules are voted as one of the first legislative actions of each new convening Senate. So there's a package. That is something that you can find in the timeline and identify clearly as a rule separate from a type of legislative action, such as filibuster. Where it's fuzzy to me is the invocation of precedent to interpret when the Senate can essentially change its own rules and not be subject to the filibuster. And that involves some legislative sleight of hand by Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd, which I think is about 40 years ago. I think probably the honest answer is rather than have me sort of give you what I think it is, let me give you a sharper answer at the start of our next class. Because I think it's important. Because I'll add one sentence, I'll come back to you. Notice everything I've talked about has been about appointments. Please do not get tripped up, and every year I have at least one or two students who do, that the filibuster does not apply to subject matter bills, non-appointment bills. That is not the case. We still have to get through the filibuster gauntlet for the regular type of legislation that we've talked about already in this course. This invocation of the nuclear option has been limited to appointments issues. And I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, Marisa, I'm having trouble hearing.
You said that the Senate gets to work, so what's the Senate?
And the House, too.
When did you say every 2 years or every 6 years?
It's usually the invocation of each Congress, which is every 2 years. Now, having said that, there is a constitutional basis for that. The Constitution gives the power to each chamber to write its own rules. So the ability to limit those rules by other actors, such as courts or the executive branch, this is actually one area where they get to make their own call. You can't sue the House over a rule that they've selected, in theory, if you read that interpretation of the rules clause. Okay? I'm looking around. Great questions, by the way. All right. So all of this has been how the process works normally, including the filibuster. So here the next question is, obviously this can produce paralysis, gridlock, legislative dysfunction. So the question then becomes, if you really want to get bills and laws passed, what are the other tools on the table to get around these veto gates, these choke points? How can you make the system work in other ways? So I put this just as a blank page here for you to think about. If you were going to print this one out, just scribble some ideas at the bottom. But the key thing here is you can modify the legislative process to ski around some of these blocks. I know that sounds a little odd. It almost sounds quasi-unconstitutional, but the truth is an increasing percentage of our most important legislation is actually being passed through unorthodox means. So what does that mean? Well, the first is, and this is the one that's increasingly done more and more, you just do all the work outside the floor of the Congress. The House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader and the key leaders of the opposing party get together and sit in a quiet room somewhere away from the hub and the din, and they strike a package deal. This depends on party discipline, but at the end of the day, they present that package to their members as a take-it-or-leave-it deal. No changes allowed. And if the issue is important enough and the party discipline is tight enough, essentially you sail through this process without having to navigate committee multiple committee referrals or hearings or conference committees. It's basically a pre-baked deal. Now, here's the question for you as lawyers. One of these pre-baked deals has been approved by Congress. You go and take a look at the legislative history. What do you think is going to be on the shelf? Radio silence. It's very challenging to use the typical tools of statutory construction that rely on statements of legislators or background materials or committee hearings if you have this type of pre-conferral, pre-agreement legislation. So does that make sense for everybody? Okay. Second, omnibus legislation. Christmas trees. This is particularly with funding legislation. You put everything into one giant bill, and then everyone has to swallow hard and pass it to get what they want, even at the price of accepting something someone else wants that they find really distasteful. These generate behemoth, particularly funding legislation and appropriations legislation, behemoth bills that, again, the legislative record, think about. What are you going to find in terms of a hearing, rationale, expertise, statements on the floor when you have a 3,000-page bill that covers everything, soup to nuts? And important provisions are tucked away in the language as part of this giant omnibus arrangement. So those are very increasingly common. Now, having said that, there are more formal ways to do this that are not just the political process. And your book talks about these, and I will tell you, these have, they have bitten me in the ankle in my practice. These are real concerns if you're a practicing lawyer. Statutized rules. Essentially, Congress says, all right, we know this process is screwed up. For certain types of legislation, we are going to legislatively dictate they are not subject to those rules. So, most of you have probably heard of fast-track legislation, if you follow trade. What's a good example of something that's under fast-track consideration right now as we speak? Well, what's the official name for it? Because you know that the current administration would never, ever, ever refer to this as NAFTA 2.0. I can't resist. U.S. Mexican-Canadian Agreement. I have no idea how you pronounce that acronym. I just think of it as the U.S. Marine Corps. But anyway, The whole point of fast-track legislation is it's impossible for the executive in exercising his or her presidential authority to negotiate an agreement with another nation and then turn around and bring it to Congress and have Congress say, ah, we are not going to accept the terms of this deal. So as a result, to avoid that loss of negotiation credibility, fast-track means that Congress pre-authorizes the president to strike a deal. And then effectively, Congress must accept it thumbs up, thumbs down on an expedited basis. We are in the process right now where the U.S.-Mexico-Canadian trade agreement is under that type of expedited review. But notice, we don't, you know, I think it's fascinating, and I'm glad to talk with you guys at any time about the, how NAFTA and the U.S.-Mexico-Canadian agreement works. But for now, what we care about is that that's Congress reaching under the hood of its own engine and changing what process applies for certain types of legislation. There's no reason they can't do that in other areas, and they do. The book mentions the Base Closure and Realignment Act, which is a wonderfully engineered process that essentially removes politicians from the crosshairs for approving the closure of military bases in their districts by using this same sort of statutized process. But the last one, the one that's probably most relevant for all of us here, and I want to make sure we do not lose time talking about it, is budget reconciliation. Now I'm pausing because I'm starting to worry that I am talking in a long, uninterrupted sentence at you. So I'm going to take a wild gamble and ask a question to the entire class, which hopefully is buried in the text, but you guys already know it by heart anyway. What is the preeminent example of the most high-profile legislation that's been passed as budget reconciliation in the past 10 years? Say again? Affordable Health Care Act. How is that a budget issue? So all of you who were, I guess now, paying a mandatory insurance premium, which was redefined. I'm sure, has Professor Rave already talked with you about the NFIB v. Sebelius case? It'll come up, I'm sure. Basically, upholding the Affordable Health Care Act as a tax under Congress's taxing power, rather than taxing a failure to do something. I'm sorry, penalizing a failure to do something, which is beyond Commerce Clause power. Separate issue. But you're right. The Affordable Care Act was passed as a budget reconciliation bill. Why on earth would Congress descend to such a strange sleight of hand to get that passed? Because previously, 40 years earlier, Congress had passed the Congressional Budget Act of 1974, which basically redefined and set up a statutized process for how to consider budget acts that takes filibusters off the table. That's what it's all about. So as a result, the Affordable Care Act is a weird beast. There are parts of it that got passed as essentially budgetary reconciliation, financial legislation that didn't have a veto associated, I'm sorry, filibuster associated with it. That is still subject to a 50 plus one vote to change and modify. Other parts of it did not, could not possibly fall under that rubric. So as a result, you cannot go back and modify those parts of the act without running up against a filibuster. So as a result, everyone knows the Affordable Care Act has sore shortfalls. They cannot be addressed unless they fall within this narrow spectrum of budget reconciliation, all because of this statutized rule process on how to consider legislation in that category. So I'll take a breath here. Does that make sense for everybody? Hopefully this all sort of rings vaguely familiar to you from watching, and you actually grew up with this whole process flaming around you. Okay? Yes? Because it was in a very narrow context. What would happen was there was arguments between President Nixon's administration and Congress as to whether or not the president had independent authority to essentially choose not to spend money that Congress directed had to be spent. So this act was meant to address that specific controversy in terms of impoundment of congressionally delegated funds for non-discretionary spending. As a result, they weren't thinking 10, 20, 30 years in the future as to how that process could be expanded to cover other types of subject areas that walk in both worlds at the same time. Now, it's an interesting question. Could you go back and make a legitimate argument that we should revisit the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 and maybe rethink it and retool it? I think you could make that very strong argument. The question is, of course, is it would be subject to filibuster. Changing the rule that limits filibusters is subject to filibuster, I know it gets like a Escher picture after a certain point. Okay? Any other questions? All right. So, the rest of this is fairly straightforward. The key thing on this slide, I want to make sure that you kind of underline and keep track for future reference. And you notice I've gone past the summary of the process for you in a graphic form. This is actually for our topics for today. Statutized rule is critical. This one on the bottom is also critical. Essentially, you can avoid filibusters, you can avoid chokeholds in the process by essentially fudging. Don't tackle the hard issues by pushing it off to someone else. And here, the push-off goes to agencies, typically, the president's executive branch. If Congress cannot reach a resolution, they can direct someone else to decide and empower them to make that decision. Now, what that means, again, as lawyers, is what's the legislative intent in that situation? I pause here and make a theatrical gesture. It's an interesting question. Congress specifically did not dictate what the answer should be in these circumstances. They've merely empowered another party to make that decision. So when you're interpreting the language underlying that decision, you may have a tough go with a judge who says, show me what they were thinking when they passed the bill, because there arguably is not a legislative intent on that specific issue. But there is a legislative intent that they will stand behind the answer that's achieved by that process as long as it complies with the statutory requirements. And referral tactics to conference committees, I think we've already talked about a little bit. Okay, last, not least, and I will say this to you probably multiple times during the course of the semester, do not forget the states. Never forget the states. You commit malpractice if you forget the states. Texas has its own process. As I point out to you, this is the same flowchart I put up on the website separately. You have similar types of choke points and veto gates and filibusters, but they're not exactly the same. So if you are before a legislative body and you're trying to get something accomplished and you're doing it on the federal level and you think the same rules translate down verbatim, do not make that mistake. In addition as well, if you are advising a client on compliance with a law on a particular issue and you get the answer in just the federal law, the odds are overwhelming for almost any topic that there's a state or local law that also applies to the same actions. And I will tell you, I have defended lawyers who have been facing questions from their malpractice carriers because they forgot to look at what the state said when they gave advice on the federal issue. I feel like I'm telling you all sorts of scary stuff today. All right, I'll stop. Questions, suggestions, thoughts? Yes.
Got overruled because she wasn't talking. She went off topic essentially three times. Is that a always requirement for a filibuster in the state senate, or was it just because of the bill? Like, do you always have to be germane in your filibuster in the state senate?
Generally, yes. I'm pausing because I'm not sure whether or not there's exceptions that I need to think about, but most filibusters I've seen stay on topic because the Texas Senate is less forgiving of long-running filibusters. They tend to require you to actually physically stay behind the podium and actually stay on your feet and actually speak to the issues. I think there's even rules about whether you can leave your hand on the podium or not. Not so in the U.S. Senate. So that, you know, Wendy's filibuster was as much a physical feat as a political feat. I'll just put it that way. There's a reason she was wearing the pink tennis shoes. Okay, any other questions? Yes, pretty soon. I'm sorry, Marisa, could you say that, which page? And which comment? Ah. What Senator Byrd is saying is rather than do away with filibusters or limit them, the best solution is to just call bluffs. If someone wants to do a filibuster, say, okay, filibuster your heart out, but you need to actually make the speech behind the podium. You need to actually stay behind that podium 24 hours a day. We're not going to adjourn in the evening. And you can't stay only Monday through Friday. You need to stay over the weekend. Yep. Yep. That's sort of the classic hard knuckles approach to filibustering. There's a reason why you would have, literally in the senator cloak rooms during the Civil Rights Act, they had cots laid out for people to actually be prepared to sleep during the filibuster. What Byrd is saying is basically is don't mess with the rules, just be more hard-nosed about applying the ones you have. It's a pretty persuasive argument when you think about it. The whole custom of holds, and also for certain presidential appointees having blue slips, where essentially one person from the state that for the office we're talking about can essentially say uh-uh, without actually having to step behind to make a statement why, they're kind of painless to the legislator, and they don't really put them in this political light to justify their actions. And Byrd's argument is that's not what a filibuster is supposed to be. If you're going to filibuster, you need to stand behind it yourself, put your body on the line. Does that help? Okay. Any others? All right. So then for next week, post-Super Bowl, we're going to actually shift gears. First of all, remember my warning or my suggestion or my promise. I'm not sure which word applies here. I am going to trim the reading for next Monday, because it's 40 pages, and that I think at that point we're starting to get into constitutional prohibitions on cruel and unusual punishment. But having said that, we are going to talk about the way the executive branch participates in the legislative process. And that is actually where lawyers play a much bigger role. We will be more involved in hearings, confirmations, oversight, investigations, than we are going to be in the actual sausage making of the bill itself. So read it with that in mind. We're going to try and cover the readings for today, including the Clinton case, as well as, by the way, I am assuming, I should have asked this. Have you guys read Chadha already? Chadha v. INS? Yes, no?
Okay.
So every professor is assuming the other professors assigned it.
Yes.
I like that. Okay. All right, I'm not going to assign it. But I am going to talk at least a couple of minutes about what it stands for, and then we're going to move ahead and talk about how the executive's participation in the legislative process influences what you can do as lawyers in applying legislative interpretation. So with that, last chance for any other questions for, I would say release you into the sunlight, but release you to your next class.
Are we going to expect an email with your page numbers?
I'm going to change the website, but I'll send, would it help if I sent the email out too?
Yeah.
Do you guys still read email? Okay. I've been told that email is the sign that you're at least over 50 years old. Okay. I will promise you, unfortunately, I just cannot do Facebook. Sorry, guys. But I will send an email to everybody and change the website. And if you want to talk, I'll be here Thursday and Friday as well. So with that, enjoy your next class. Oh, I'm sorry. I have another class this afternoon, so it probably won't be until either close of business today or first thing tomorrow morning. Either end of day today or first thing tomorrow morning. Oh, sure. So there you go.
Yes, there we are. Oh.